You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
Although the Second City isn't doing in-person shows, classes, or events, we're doing all of those things virtually. Head over to secondcity.com and you can sign up for a class. We've got really affordable drop-in classes where you might be improvising with people from other countries. We're doing corporate workshops and events. And we have a whole new slate of virtual shows that you can get tickets to. Get more comedy in your life by going to secondcity.com. Welcome to the world of Tony Ho from CBC Podcasts. It's an award-winning, bite-sized narrative comedy series about human relationships, familiar, hilarious, and sometimes unnerving. The troupe features Miguel Rivas, Adam Niebergall, and alumnus of the Second City mainstage, Roger Bainbridge. They will take you on a darkly comedic ride that finds honesty in every situation. You can listen and subscribe to Tony Ho on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
My guest today is Marissa King. She is a professor of organizational behavior at Yale, and she's written this really terrific new book. It's called Social Chemistry, Decoding the Patterns of Human Connection. We don't go into this a lot in the podcast itself, but there are examples of work with so many of our podcast guests. Duncan Watts, Francesca Gina, Baker Keltner, Amy Edmondson, Allison Wood Brooks, all of these people that we've talked to over time or you've heard me talk about are brought up in this really fascinating look at the role social networks play in work, in life. So I think you're really going to enjoy the conversation.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting the Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Marissa King, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here, Kelly.
So you start the book by talking about Vernon Jordan, who folks might remember was a civil rights activist and a business executive, but he also became the ultimate Washington, D.C. insider, a confidant to presidents and a connector to the powerful and the elite. And you write, quote, Jordan represents both the power and the perceived problems of networks, end quote. How so?
In many ways, Vernon Jordan really embodies this tension about how we think about networks. On the one hand, he was the grandson of a sharecropper, really broke ground in the civil rights movement, has been called the Rosa Parks of Wall Street, and helped create connections between worlds that normally wouldn't speak together. And in bringing those together, he created immense value for himself, but also really helped transform business and social life. But at the same time, oftentimes he's perceived as just being a networker in the sense of what does he really do? What really is his value added? And on the personal level, that tension has also created him, and many times he'll share really in an impassioned way about this sense of just feeling completely lonely and isolated despite having this really extensive network. So on the one hand, there's enormous possibility for social change and for profound transformation in our networks, both at a personal and a social level. But the downside is oftentimes it can really come off as swarmy or self-interested. And as a result, it can often lead to feelings of isolation and loneliness.
So there's tons of great evidence in the book and cool stories. Before we sort of jump into that, we should probably go through these sort of designations that you do offer in the book around expansionists, brokers, and conveners. So let's do a quick sort of like, what are these three designations basically?
Yeah, if you think about how we live our social lives in every moment, whether it's waking up in the morning and interacting with a stranger in line for coffee versus having an enduring conversation with a long friend, all of those interactions leave traces, and those traces are really our networks. And you can think about your network as just a map of where you've been and where you're likely to go. And different types of predispositions and ways through moving through the world lead to different types of networks. And among these, we can really think about three different types that have emerged from research in the past 30 years: expansionists, brokers, and conveners. Expansionists are your quintessential networkers. They know how to work a room. They, if you ask them how many people named Adam do they know, they're going to know two or more, right? Which is really, they have extraordinarily large networks, which is helpful for giving them influence and access to information. Brokers, on the other hand, tend to span different social worlds. They usually have unusual career paths. They move around quite a bit. They're good at giving impromptu speeches on things they know nothing about. And because they span and bring together different social worlds, they're really innovative and creative. And then the final type, conveners, tend to have friends who are friends with one another. They tend to have enduring social relationships. And as a result, their networks are really imbued with trust and reciprocity. So different ways of living their social lives, where they spend their time, creates different network signatures, which have really different benefits and drawbacks.
And you can, there's fluidity between these, right? You can operate as one at one point and as another at a different point.
Yeah. And over the course of our lives, these actually change quite dramatically. Our networks are largest when we're 25. So people tend to be an expansionist earlier in their lives. Moving into parenthood is like falling off a social cliff. So different moments in our lives have different impacts on our networks. And one of the nice things about this is it also means, though, that you can change the structure of your network to meet your needs. So if you need more social support, changing the way that you're engaging in your relationships can help offer that.
So when I do my notes for the podcast, I sometimes do it by chapter. This I started to do a bunch of different stuff. So my first little section is what we have wrong. You write in the book, quote, "Decades of research has shown that the myopic focus on network size is misguided." So this is probably a surprise to people who are like, "Hey, I've got, 100,000 Twitter followers. I've got all these people on LinkedIn. So I win." But that's not necessarily the case all the time.
No, it's certainly not the case. And that was one of the biggest things that drove me to write this book. Is in my own professional life, we hear again and again in the media, right? You need to expand your network. You need to meet more people. You need to go to professional events. And like, for me, walking into a ballroom where people are wearing name tags, it just makes me cringe inside. But what I knew from research is that, in fact, how many people you know or the size of your network has very little impact on the things we care about. If you look at how likely you are to die prematurely, how happy you are, whether or not you're going to succeed in your career, whether your kids feel supported, all of those factors, the things we actually really care about, are much more determined by the quality of your relationships and the way that your network's structured. It's not about network size.
Tell us about what the liking gap is.
Yeah, the liking gap certainly helps me. And one of the issues I think when people have this aversion to thinking about working a room like I do is that there's often this sense of, I don't know how to do it. And one of the more surprising things to me in writing this book was realizing that everyone feels like they don't know how to do it. So if you look at most aspects of our lives, like we think we're better than average. Like we think we're better than average at driving a car. We think we're smarter than average. We tend to think that we're better than average. But in reality, when it comes to social relationships, people really underestimate how much people like them. And in studies that have actually delved into this to try to understand how much of this is true by asking people to engage in a conversation and asking both parties to report, how much do you think Kelly liked you? And then asking Kelly, how much did you really like Marissa? Right? There's almost always a gap in the sense that we underestimate how well the conversation actually went. So that after conversation regret is completely normal.
Yeah, I mean, Nick Epley's work at the University of Chicago is all about this, about how much we just like dread these conversations and then they end up actually being fine, if not good. And this is like over and over and over again, the ways we misperceive situations is like rampant.
Yeah, and I think that it unfortunately really impedes our ability to connect with one another, that like fear and self-regret, it really impedes our ability to truly connect. And your work that you do on improvisation, I guess, is really helps overcome some of this in ways that trying to just think your way out of it doesn't.
No, you can't think your way out of it. So about 2 weeks ago, the podcast that dropped was this interview I had. It was one of my favorite interviews. This guy's named Sanford Greenberg. He's maybe 80-something-year-old philanthropist. And the reason I booked it, was when the pitch came in, the foreword was written by Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and the afterword was written by Margaret Atwood. And Sanford went blind junior year in college, and his roommate helped him get through it, and his roommate was Art Garfunkel. And I was just like, and the closing chapter is an entire conversation between him and David Rockefeller.
Wow.
Yeah, right? And I mean, and this guy's a lovely human being and has this incredible, I mean, he's the way he thinks about blindness and that he sees no horizons because he can't. It is just really sort of lovely sort of poetry, and the book's amazing. And you talk about Rockefeller, who has this had this legendary Rolodex that was like, how many miles, like if they had stretched out, it would have gone like certain miles, right?
Yeah, 16 miles.
16 mile Rolodex. How would that fit in the room?
It was in lots and lots of very, very large file cabinets.
Really?
Yeah.
So you bring up Rockefeller for a point. What is the point of talking about David?
Yeah, I mean, he is one of these people that really has focused on network size, and in many ways also embodies this same contradiction as Byrne and Jordan, in the sense that he was very systematic about his relationships, that his Rolodex wasn't just a list of names and numbers, but he kept detailed notes on every single person that he met. Mm-hmm. And while for many people this is off-putting, there's a reality to it in the sense that we all, regardless of whether they're Rockefeller, just have smaller aspirations, have cognitive limits on how big our network can be. Mm-hmm. And because of those cognitive limits, if we want to expand our network and we want to expand our reach, then we need to actually utilize tools to do that effectively. And David Rockefeller is really emblematic in this regard. He wasn't really predisposed to naturally building a huge network. In fact, there's a great story he will often tell about just like wanting to play with Beatles as a little boy. He was quite introverted, but he figured out ways of being able to connect and reinforce his relationships by using more systematic methods. But oftentimes those systematic methods also created some aversion to his way of thinking about relationships.
The interesting thing about this book too is that it reveals a limited scope in which we have been considering our networks in a variety of different areas. And obviously with my interest in improvisation, a lot of that is about, because people are like, what's the difference between sort of spontaneity and improvisation? And I'm like, well, improvisation is a practiced sort of spontaneity, is purposeful, and there's meaning behind it. And I think that's really poignant when you think about this thing that you say in the book, which is, quote, unless you purposefully create spontaneity, your network will likely suffer the same fate as a garden that never experiences crop rotation. Productivity will decrease. So that is what you're kind of talking about, is like you have to allow space for sort of improvised moments and surprise inside of these networks, or they're going to sort of dry up.
That's absolutely true. And if you think about it, right, part of it is just humans really are just predictable as plants, in the sense that if I know where you were yesterday at 4 p.m. and I know where you were yesterday, the day before yesterday at 4 p.m., I can predict with an extremely high level of accuracy where you're going to be tomorrow at 4 p.m. And because we tend to be in the same places at the same times, we tend to run into the same people. And unless you engineer some shift, then the likelihood that you're going to meet anyone new, or particularly anyone that perhaps looks different from you or thinks different from you, is really, really small, just because humans tend to be so stuck to routine.
So this seems like a good shift to talk about weak ties, strong ties, and dormant ties, because I think this is and we've talked to other behavioral scientists on the program about this, but I want to kind of go over that because they're each important in their own way, but surprisingly important in sort of, you know, the reverse order, where like you would think a dormant tie would be like, well, I haven't talked to this person. Actually, I had this moment today. A friend of mine needed a space like at 1 o'clock. He sent me a note at 8 a.m. And I haven't talked to my friend who works at Virgin Hotel in like 4 years, sent him a note. He's like, great, what space do you need? Oh, and by the way, I've been following you on social media. And like, then we just had this very funny back and forth. And it was like, oh, like he wasn't bothered in the least by me reaching out.
Yeah, people want to help. And speaks to this notion of there are huge parts of our network that are just untapped and that we don't actually have an accurate understanding of where the true value lies. And much of it is in these weak ties and dormant ties. So if we think of, or you can think about your network really as a series of concentric circles. So at the center of that circle are your strongest ties. They're the 2 to 5 people that you turn to if you're in crisis, you're having an emotional breakdown, you need financial help. And then if we move out from that, we can think about our weaker ties or our friends or our acquaintances that we don't see as often, or they may even be colleagues that we see every day, but we don't have a lot of emotional depth to our relationship. And while our inner circle is really, really important, especially during times like now when we need a lot of emotional support, there are also benefits to these outer circles. And those benefits really are information benefits. So our weak ties, our acquaintances are not a part of this inner circle where there oftentimes is this echo chamber. And so by reaching out, whether it's a weak tie, so an acquaintance, or a dormant tie, which is someone you may have had a strong relationship with but haven't talked to in a long time, you're getting a different set of benefits. And all of us, though, are forced to make the trade-off of where are we going to devote most of our time and effort. So some people are much more likely to focus just on that inner core versus brokers, for instance, or spend much more time in these outer layers.
I find social media is actually perfect for tending to your weak ties.
Yeah, I mean, I think the best thing that social media does is allow you to reinforce existing relationships, and that's about it. But it also allows you to have an understanding of who's there. Because oftentimes, one of the things that we know in times of crises, whether that's COVID or other crises, is our perceptions of our networks actually shrink. Mm-hmm. So what was actually there, we don't see. But as you mentioned, Kelly, right, the social media is good for allowing us to see who really is there that we can turn to and ask for help.
So a bit of research that you talk about here is the Stanford sociologist, Mark Granovetter, if I'm pronouncing that right. Tell us about this study, because I think it's fascinating in terms of where people get their sort of job info.
Yeah, around 30 years ago, Mark Granovetter was trying to figure out how people get their jobs. And he went door to door, just simply asking people where they got their jobs. And what he found is that most people got their jobs through people they knew. But what was surprising is his research. And when he kept reaching out and saying, like, your friend, and they would repeat, correct him and say, no, it wasn't a friend, it was an acquaintance. And that's still true today. Decades later, research again and again has found that most jobs are gone through personal connections. Personal connections lead to shorter periods of unemployment. They lead to better jobs. They lead to higher status jobs. They lead to higher paying jobs. But for all those jobs, you're much more likely to get your job through these weak ties or acquaintances than someone you know quite well.
I got my son a job at Second City working in the box office, and he just got hired for this like real job. And one of his texts to me, it was like, I'm just really happy I'm getting a job, not from you. And literally it was someone he worked with for a couple months, you know, who he hadn't been seen in ages, and she recommended him, and he got work. So it's like proof in action. One of the things I want to talk about is the word authenticity gets thrown around a lot. And I don't think everyone always knows what they mean when they say authenticity. And you talk about this in the book, and you say, quote, to be more authentic, we first need to become more self-aware. So if that's the starting point of authenticity, where are we going with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, right, if you don't have an understanding of who you are, then it's impossible to move into relationships with other people in any way that feels comfortable to you. So I think if we think about why we even care about authenticity in this regard, a lot of it is just being able to move, for me anyway, it's being able to move into social relationships in a way that is comfortable and honest. Mm-hmm. And I think in order to do that, you actually have to have a level of self-awareness about what actually is honest. And that, I think, for many people is oftentimes a challenge. And one of the beauties both of your work, but also just being in, literally embodied, is we can start to feel that in ways like, oh, that doesn't feel exactly right. And I think from that self-awareness, you can start to move through the world and then into relationships in a way that feels much more comfortable.
Yeah, there's a lesson from stand-up comedy in here, I've been in improv and sketch and theater and was not, you know, I like stand-up, but it's not my field. But one of the things, and my wife's a comedy professor, so she's taught me this, which is that stand-ups have to do a thing called, you know, perspective giving. They have to let someone know who they are. And they often do that by starting with the things they're bad at. So, you know, whether it's John Mulaney making fun of the fact that he's a terrible driver, or Patton Oswalt is Shortened Fat or whatever, Amy Schumer, that they all do this opening thing. And then you're like, oh, and you connect with them and you sort of trust them, but it's through their faults. And I think that that's also a way that people don't understand that, like, people kind of like it when you share with them your, you know, no one wants to, like, who wants a story of everything going right? Like, I want a fiasco. I am interested in your fiascos.
That's hilarious. As you were describing that, the first thing you said when you started talking about stand-up comedy and your wife being a comedy professor, I'm like, oh, I'm just not funny. But there's, right, and it's true. Like, I think if you can start from that place of, like, honest humility, you can start to engage with one another on a really human level. And I think the problem arises is when people aren't in touch with that and they try to pretend to be something they aren't or project. And this is particularly, I think, difficult early on in life, right? When you haven't, like, become okay with not being okay, that projection makes it next to impossible to actually connect on the human level. Like, oh, we all make mistakes. We all have flaws. And if you can start from that place of, like, let me tell you all the things that are wrong, it just changes the level at which you're interacting.
By the way, my wife leads with, said she's not funny. That is her lead thing. Cause she knows, she's like, I'm not going to be a laugh riot for you. I just know a lot about the structure of comedy. Okay. If you had wanted to write an incredibly commercial book that would make you a lot of money, I'm going to tell you how you could have done it. And it's built around this piece of advice you give, about when you enter a room and dyads and triads. I have now, like, I finished this book, I don't know, like 6-7 days ago. I have talked to like 7 or 8 people about this, and they've all been like, that's genius. Sort of explain what this thing is. And you did do it. It's kind of like self-help for you too, right?
It is. I mean, right, you teach what you need. So it sounds like your wife needs comedy, and I need to know how to enter and work a room. So the idea is, if we can understand really the most basic elements of social structure, that we can enter social situations in a way that allows us to move more effectively. And if you do this and you walk into a room, so imagine you're walking into that ballroom that I talked about at the beginning, and you see the name tags. For most people, when you walk in, you're just going to see a wall of people. And for me, even just mentioning it, my heart rate starts to increase. My palms get a little sweaty, right? If I could leave, I would leave. Mm-hmm. But you walk in, and if you first realize that people actually don't form walls, that they form clumps of people, then instead of seeing just a wall of people, you can start to see islands. And then ask yourself, right, which island am I going to go to? And in thinking about that, when you ask, which island are you going to go to? There's lots of defaults of human behavior. Many people will look for where someone they already know and go there. Other times it'll be that I'm going to look for, someone who seems friendly or is like me and go there. But what we actually know is that humans aren't just in clumps, right? That they often, when we're in conversation, it's really, really difficult to be in a conversation with an odd number group. So when you're trying to figure out where you want to go and you're looking at these islands, if you look simply for where there's an odd number group, there's going to be someone there who needs a conversational partner. We have 2 eyes and we have 2 ears that hone in on single voices. And because of that, really, if you want to break into a conversation, you need to look for an odd number group, whether it's a group of 1, so the lone person standing by themselves, or a group of 3, it's going to be much more natural to engage in a conversation. And also doing that just makes the whole thing feel much more comfortable than simply that ball of people.
It's really brilliant. Have you done this? Have you practiced this stuff out?
Absolutely. I really need this stuff to get through, like, basic social situations.
You're a nerdy academic. Yeah, no, I know. I mean, like, I'm clearly an extrovert, but I'm married to an introvert. And even I don't like those things. Like, no one likes those things. Our friend David Hornick, though he hates conferences so much, he created his own conference called The Lobby, and it is just the social events. There's no speakers. But he just crafts these sort of interesting events, but they're actually directed so that there's a way for people to know how to have conversation or how to get inside the stuff. Another sort of geeky comedy thing that we think about all the time is sort of space and distance, because, you know, it's like how far you are from an event happening, like 9/11 happening, like, in about a year in Chicago, we could, you know, start to play with that comedically. We wouldn't have been able to do that in New York at that time. And then 10 years we can away from that issue, New York or otherwise, you can kind of say anything. And then that's also sort of the distance you are between your audiences and how many and all that. And you talk about how space has this really strong effect on relationships. And I thought it was really interesting. So, you know, tell us about the ways in what you're talking about, space becomes an issue.
Yeah, I mean, space has a huge impact on who we're going to become friends with, who we're going to actually form collaborations with. And some of my favorite work on this is actually from the 1950s, quite early, looking at dorms at MIT to see how likely people were to interact. And they compared just people randomly assigned to live near each other and compared how likely you were to become friends with someone who's right next door, two doors down at the end of the hallway or on another floor. And there's just an amazing precipitous drop off with moving very small distances away from one another. And so if you think about why this is true, it's just a lot of it's just simple mere familiarity. The more we see something, the more we like it. And I think one of the challenges actually has been that people have taken this idea, right, that there's a death to social relationships with distance. And they've actually tried to engineer this. You were just talking about engineering social relationships, right? By building open office spaces, and have taken this actually far too much the other way. Yeah. But where we live, whether that's, you know, how close is our next door neighbor versus do we live on a cul-de-sac, right? Cul-de-sacs are the best way of actually creating neighborhood relationships versus a through street. But where we choose to sit in an office versus which house on the block we choose, all of that has a profound effect on what our networks look like, but we often make these choices with no regard in mind to how they're going to actually shape our lives.
Very early in my career, I was having a conversation with Harold Ramis, who directed Ghostbusters was in Ghostbusters and directed Groundhog Day and all that. And I go, what advice would you give me? And he says, find the funniest person in the room and stand next to them. And for him, that was John Belushi when he was at Second City. And I was like, that is actually great prescient advice that apparently has science to back it up.
That's fabulous. It's like that both you can learn from them and it's just a halo effect.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I think both things can be true. But that idea, and it was interesting too, in reading some of the later stuff in the book around brokerage and recombination. So the sort of hallmark of my career at Second City was actually when I started doing all these collaborations. So I partnered with Renee Fleming and Lyric Opera, and we ended up creating Second City Guide to the Opera and doing workshops, and then did a similar show with Hubbard Street Dance, where it was contemporary dance and comedy and improvisation. We did a Second City Christmas Carol with the Goodman Theater, and it was all about sort of assembling these sort of different parts, putting together to create something that maybe had never been seen before, but it was only somewhat original. It was original in the sense that it was mashing together different things.
Yeah. I mean, all innovation really is recombination, right? Whether no matter what type of mashing it is. One of my favorite examples of this is the printing press, right? Like you look at a picture of an original printing press and it's quite obvious looking at it, right? It's just a wine press and a coin punch put together. So these things we think of as radically transformative that change our lives, whether in fundamental ways, are actually not new. But the problem is that most of us exist in echo chambers in the sense we're surrounded by people with our same level of expertise, our same interests. And so we don't have the opportunity to be exposed to these different ways of thinking and different ideas, but just simply putting them together, in most cases, really magic can happen in a way that's just not that magic, I guess, because it happens again and again and again.
We had the head of Radio Flyer on the program, and that red wagon was originally just where his grandfather kept his tools. And then when the kids would come in, they'd be picking up furniture or whatever, they'd always want to play in the wagon. And then there was like, And then that ended up being the thing that is sort of ubiquitous everywhere. Also, this is like a total thing of artists. You mentioned Yo-Yo Ma as being someone who's done a lot of these sort of collaborations. I thought of another one, which was Elvis Costello, who is constantly saying like his best-selling albums are like the stuff he did with Burt Bacharach and Kronos Quartet. It's not his sort of well-known sort of rock stuff.
That's super interesting. And so it's like just putting together melding the different styles is where this idea of just path-breaking music really comes from.
Yeah, and I love that. And Ma's work, especially like the sort of, Goat Rodeo, I think it's called, is band with Chris Tilly and all these interesting people. Okay, there's so much, but I have way too many notes and we don't have a lot of time, but there's a couple more things I want to talk about before I'm going to ask you for a yes and story. So for people who don't know about Shep Gordon, and I actually had the pleasure of meeting Shep through Mike Myers, an incredible character. Talk about him and how you reference him in the book.
Shep Gordon is quite the character in the sense that he basically showed up in LA with no plan of what he was going to do. And by happenstance, he ended up becoming a manager, and he's managed people from Alice Cooper to Emil, a huge range of impressive characters. Worked with Kenny Rogers. You know, it's like all across the board of people you would not really imagine. And oftentimes he's referred to as one of the really the most powerful agents in Hollywood. And if we think about really though what he is doing, he created this profoundly impactful network. But despite the fact that he had this extraordinary reach, again, there was a moment of crisis in his life when he was facing severe health complications. And at that point, he looked around and the only person who was by his bedside in the hospital was his assistant. And that for him was this moment of like, oh my God, like I have focused on expanding and meeting and growing my network, which it was essential for his success, but it left him really without any of these core relationships. But one of the things that did, but also a principle that he lives his life by that is really inspiring is this notion of like just favors, right? Like he like is very, very serious in a really profound way about this notion of reciprocity and building trust and building relationships moving forward in a way that has to sort of counteract, I think, that moment of like profound isolation. Like he's realized the importance of investing in other relationships.
Yeah, and that's all Adam Grant's research around the give and take, and the guy I mentioned, David Hornick, is in Give and Take. That's one of the case studies. One of the things that we work on very strongly in improvisation is listening. So the idea that when anyone is walking in the room beginning improv class, we are assuming that you think you're a good listener, and what we know is that you are not. And you actually have the research about who the best listeners of all are, right?
Yeah, I found this surprising. One of the quote unquote like fathers of listening actually was really curious about trying to understand who is a good listener. And what he did is he studied people in a variety of different settings. And what he found is of all the people he studied, that it turned out that first graders were in fact the best listeners.
Wow. So I have
young kids, so this came as a huge shock for me. But what it is this notion of that first graders are not listening for what's coming next in the conversation. They're not thinking about what they already know, that they're just actually open to truly being in the moment and listening to what's being heard. And that suspension of judgment and being able to truly be present is really why first graders turn out to be such good listeners.
Yeah, and they're natural improvisers. They play with anyone, right? It's funny. My kids went to Chicago Waldorf, and they talk about risky play, which is a thing I love. And they've just got like it's so inventive, and we see how that gets sort of like educated out of us until we get into the workforce, and then it gets dragged out of us. And so often it belies any understanding of how people are creative. It's stunning to me. All right. One more thing, and I'm going to ask you for yes and story, which is you say in the book, quote, gossip often gets a bad rap.
Yeah. I mean, I think that we often are kind of look down on gossip, but there's been fantastic research that was really led by Robin Dunbar looking at what do we actually talk about when we're talking? And he's found that close to 60% of our conversational time is actually spent gossiping or talking about someone who's not in the room. And while that might seem simply like a waste of time, it actually turns out that there are huge evolutionary advantages to this. So for us to evolve as a society, we in many ways had to be able to understand who has our back, who's actually enforcing norms, and that gossip was really critical in that regard. So in many ways, we as a society can't function without gossip. And that's really also critical to being able to trust one another. So even though it gets a bad rap, it's absolutely essential.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of the ethics game, right? I mean, if we're not going to behave rationally, if we've discovered that with human beings, we need these nudges to sort of keep us going in the right direction. All right. So we always end the podcast by asking our guests for a yes and story. In the parlance of improvisation, when groups of people are making something out of nothing, they get nowhere by saying no. And actually don't get that far by saying yes. We say you have to say yes and. You have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. Do you have a yes and story for us?
I do have a yes and story for you. So when I was starting out my career, I'm trained as a sociologist, and sociologists really, I'm not even just trained as a sociologist. I was trained in ways that kind of make business seem bad. And so when I was looking or thinking about where I wanted to go for a job, it was suggested to me that I might take a look at a business school. And my instinct was just like, no, absolutely not. There's no way that this is going to be a fit for me. But I think for me, like, it did take two yes ands. Like, so the first yes was saying yes to find, I'll take a look at this. And what made me actually decide to move down that path was just simply my colleagues. There was a space where there was so much creativity. There was a lot of innovation. There was a lot of passion, and it just felt right. But when I got there, I still knew nothing about business. And I really, really, really struggled in order to just figure out, like, you know, it's very much like the same as working a room, like how to actually exist in this environment in which I don't know how to interact. But the beauty of that is in searching and figuring out how to actually engage with humans and understanding the science behind it, I eventually was able to change that and to transform that both for myself, but also hopefully by creating the book, share some of the lessons I learned along the way with others.
I taped a podcast 2 days ago with Shelley Archambault, who's the first African-American CEO in tech, essentially. And she's written this really great book. And we kept talking about your book. And because, you know, she is someone who, you know, grew up in, you know, she was beaten up. The slurs were thrown at her. And then she's always sort of felt like an outsider, which she says gave her a kind of superpower in terms of understanding people, you know, that idea. And Dacre's work actually touches on this too, where you become more empathetic and you see true things because you kind of have to. It's a survival instinct. But I think, and she talks about she hates the term work-life balance. And she's like, I prefer work-life integration. And I'm like, yeah, that's it. And I think for you, which is, yeah, the reason the business stuff feels so off-putting is because it is. And once the enlightened businesses understand that they have human beings working for them mm-hmm. who need to be tended as human beings, it's all going to sort of break in a much better fashion. So I'm hopeful because obviously, you know, I talk to a lot of the people you work with and in that world. And what I hope is we're producing leaders who are going to understand that when they walk into these sort of old structures and work to change them so that they are less off-putting and open to all kinds of humans.
More human and more connected. I love that. It's a beautiful goal for all of us to work towards.
The book is called Social Chemistry, Decoding the Patterns of Human Connection. Marissa King, thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks so much, Kelly. It was a pleasure.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is LF Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com. Feet.
survive.